Census figures show the number of people in the U.S. age 65 and up rose by 14 million people between the years 2000 and 2016. By 2050, people over the age of 60 are expected to make up 25% of the country's population. Joining us to discuss how to meet the needs of this aging population are Scripps Gerontology Center Executive Director and Miami University Distinguished Professor, Department of Sociology and Gerontology, Dr. Suzanne Kunkel. Suzanne, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Miami University Department of Sociology and Gerontology Adjunct Associate Professor and Director of Research, Dr. Jane Carnes-Straker. Jane, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Director of the Ohio Long-Term Care Research Project at the Scripps Gerontology Center and Miami University Department of Sociology and Gerontology Professor, Dr. Bob Applebaum. Bob, good afternoon.
Thanks.
And Executive Director of the Knowles of Oxford, Ross Farnsworth. Ross, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Now, we won't be able to take your calls during the show, but you can still email questions to us. The email address is talk@wvxu.org, or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter, and we will be taking questions and comments from members in the audience this afternoon. So, Suzanne, let's start by talking about this demographic shift that's going on in the country. How do you characterize this, and how significant is this?
It's incredibly significant. It is a truly unprecedented demographic reality that we're living in right now. We have never had as many older people. We've never had such a high proportion of older people. We've never had such a fast growth of the older population. And never before have we been able to say that every single nation in the world is experiencing population aging. And we're actually going to meet a significant crossroads in about 2 years. It will be the point at which there are proportionally more older people in the world than there are children under the age of five. So globally, it's an incredible phenomenon. It has lots of implications. It's, of course, happening in the United States, as you said, at, again, an unprecedented rate as the baby boomers enter later life. And then, of course, it's happening in every state and in every county in our country.
Bob, what do you think is driving this? What's fueling this growth in the older population?
Well, the population grows older when two things happen, when we have fewer children and when we live longer. And both of those things are happening in the United States and certainly in Ohio. Ohio, as a state, we have the sixth largest, oldest population in the United States. And if you look at what's going to happen to our population over the next even just 15 years, the overall state population grows by 1.5%, but the older population will grow by 40%. So the challenges that Suzanne is talking about are really going to be highlighted for the state of Ohio.
Ross, what impact is this going to have on the country, on society?
Sure. Well, when people grow older and they live longer, they have to figure out how they're going to pay for expenses, whether it's long-term care, assisted living, additional health care expenses. So as a long-term care provider, it causes us to change the way we think and how we can provide more services to the community members, not only residents at the Knowles of Oxford.
Jane, what do you see as being the challenges that are going to be faced by this older population?
Well, I think there are a number of challenges. Aging touches basically every aspect of society. So along with aging, unfortunately, also comes some disability or some needs for assistance. So those pose the challenges for transportation systems that are accessible, housing that's accessible, ways of modifying jobs, keeping people engaged, allowing them to make a contribution. Finances, as Ross mentioned, basically everything that has to do with people in our society is going to be facing some changes and challenges.
And may I jump in just to echo some of what Jane said? This demographic reality that is undeniable, I think there are two ways to look at it, and I think probably everybody in this room has some experience with the challenges of aging, the needs for long-term care, for financial planning, for family caregiving. But the demographics are really, we can either see them as sort of a headwind that we have to, really struggle against, or we could see them as a tailwind that really will help us think differently about aging, to help us really envision a new framework for seeing the possibilities for continued contribution and independence across a life course. I think most of us are are certainly deeply concerned about and attentive to the needs that accompany aging at a certain stage in our lives, but I hope we can also keep in mind the opportunities that we have with an unprecedented aging population to think differently about aging and to really reframe aging.
Yeah, we're talking about the statistics nationally, and Bob touched on what's going on in Ohio. Suzanne, what are the statistics about the aging population, the elderly population in the state of Ohio?
So as Bob said, we're going to have really virtually no growth in the overall population of the state of Ohio, but we are going to see a 40% increase in the 65-plus population. And it is the case that there are really two major things at work there, and that is fewer babies and increased longevity. But the other big thing that's happening for Ohio is migration out of the state. So this is really an economic and workforce development issue for the state of Ohio. But the bottom line, by 2030, Ohio is projected to have 2.6 million people over the age of 65. There are some counties that are aging much faster, that have a higher proportion than the state on average. And those tend to be the counties where older people have lived their whole lives. They're remaining exactly where they've always been. They're what they want to age in place. But younger people are leaving to find jobs and different economic opportunities.
So some counties aging faster. What about in Southwest Ohio? What about local?
Southwest Ohio, actually, Hamilton County is almost exactly on par with the state of Ohio. Brown County is aging a little faster. Butler County will be forever young because of Miami University. The student population will really help Butler County remain young on average, but the more rural areas of Butler County are aging right on par with the state.
Could I just add that if you look at the migration that Suzanne mentioned, there's only one age group in Ohio where we have more people coming in than leaving as an age group, and that's 80-plus. And so if you're doing economic development, that's not exactly the statistics that you're looking for building an economy. But what happens is older people might retire and move to a southern state or warmer climate. But then what we see is when people become frail and become disabled, they want to go back and be closer to their families. And so we actually have an in-migration for that very oldest age group. So that creates, again, a number of economic challenges to the state as we age.
Bob, how prepared are we for this?
Well, we're not really well prepared either as states or as individuals. I think one of the challenges is that we all know that someday we're probably going to die, but it's a lot more difficult for us to think of ourselves as being disabled, particularly being severely disabled. So even when we talk to people who do this, who are planners, I talked to a group of attorneys who are financial planners, and I asked them how many of them thought that they would someday be severely disabled, and only a very small percentage of them said yes. So I think that if you can't picture yourself as being severely disabled, then you don't do the kinds of things you need to plan both financially, changing your house or changing your environment or saving, because it's a lot easier to spend money than it is to save it, as we know. And so as individuals, we're not well prepared. And quite frankly, as a state, we're not well prepared. So on either case, are we ready for what's going to happen?
Yeah. Are you saying that we're in denial? Is that what you need?
I think that would be a good description. Certainly, and disability doesn't happen to all of us. Some of us may just have a heart attack one day and that'll be it. And other of us will live a long time with a disability, with Alzheimer's, with other kinds of diseases. And so it is variable. And so you do have to roll the dice a little bit. And unfortunately, for most of us, we're rolling the dice and we don't know what the conclusion is going to be. So it's a little risky.
Yeah, Russ, I wanted to get your perspective on level of preparation.
Sure. I think I could definitely echo the denial piece. I think it's hard for people to come to terms with that, and so I don't think we plan as we should.
Do you agree with that? Suzanne?
We will give Jane a chance.
Yeah. We'll get Jane in here.
Absolutely. I think we, as individuals, fail to plan. I will say, though, that the state of Ohio, while we still haven't done nearly what we need to do to be prepared, in the last 15 to 20 years, the state of Ohio has really made a shift from being focused on taking care of older adults in nursing homes, to recognizing that people want to age in place, they want to stay in their homes. So we really made some budgetary shifts to keep people in the community as long as possible. And so that's, if that continues, we will be in better shape than we might have been without any attention to it at all.
Mm-hmm. Suzanne.
I was just going to add that denial or lack of preparation related to individuals is partly because for most of us, needing long-term care services and supports is a gradual process. And so people find ways to get by, families find way to get by, and by the time we realize, well, we have a problem here, then things have progressed pretty far. And I think that's one of the reasons it's hard to plan. The other reason that we aren't exactly where we need to be, though the shifts have been really remarkable and important, we still focus very heavily on dealing with problems after they occur rather than prevention and creating environments that support the mobility and engagement of older adults and that support health promotion and prevention of disease.
The term aging in place has come up several times. First off, if you would explain what that means, Suzanne. And then what is the trend? I mean, is this what more and more people want as they get older?
Absolutely. It is probably a nearly universal experience that people want to stay where they are. They may want to downsize, but they still want to live independently in their communities, in their own homes for as long as possible. So aging in place is very much a reality, and there are some really exciting initiatives happening in our nation and actually in other countries as well. And one of them is the age-friendly community movement, age-friendly cities, age-friendly communities. And actually Oxford, Ohio is in the midst of this process where stakeholders of all kinds, public officials, community organizations band together to declare their intention to figure out how we can make this a better place for people to live their entire lives and continue to contribute. So Oxford has just initiated this process. We're finding out what it is that older people people of all ages have to say about how age-friendly this community is and then what we might do about it. And one more thing about aging in place and age-friendly initiatives is we've learned, other communities have learned, that changes you make to accommodate older adults, to make this more age-friendly, actually make this a community that's more livable and more hospitable to everyone.
Now, before we went to break, we were talking about the idea of aging in place, aging at home. And there's the concept of CCRC. Bob, I'm wondering if you can explain what that is.
Well, Ross is running a CCRC, so he'll be the one. But I would say that called a continuing care retirement community, and the idea is that you have options for living that cut across from independent to apartment style to assisted living to nursing home. And the idea is once you move in, you'll be able to live there for the rest of your life. And I'll let Ross take
it
from there.
Right. So for our model at the Knolls, typically individuals move into independent living in one of our villas where we like to enable them as long as they can safely live there. And age in place. If they need to move to assisted living, we do have apartments, whether it's a one or two bedroom, and then we do also have skilled nursing for that, you know, for rehabilitation services and long term care. So above and beyond the traditional CCRC, we also have certified home health and hospice care as well. So it's just those additional services we can layer on to help folks age in place in their villas. Is ideally our goal. But if they need the additional levels of care, we have those as well.
And if I could just add, the CCRCs are a popular concept, but it turns out that most people, both in Ohio and across the country, actually remain in their own homes or move to some kind of other community residence. And so even though we have Ross and the Knolls here in Oxford, most people that live in Oxford as they age will not live in the Knolls. They'll continue to live in their community. And I think that, as Suzanne said earlier, that's really the trend. And what we've seen now is a lot more supports and services in place for people to be able to do that. So, in fact, over the last 15 years, and Jane mentioned this, the nursing home occupancy rates in Ohio have actually gone down. We've been involved in a more than 20-year study with the state, and even though we have a lot more old people today than we ever have, we actually have fewer people every day living in nursing homes in Ohio.
Jane, how are we doing in terms of housing for the aging population?
Housing probably continues to be one of the greatest challenges. As Suzanne mentioned, one of the things that we find is when we make housing modifications that meet the needs of older adults, well, it certainly meets the needs of everyone. So, you know, mothers with strollers can navigate with ramps, and so can older adults who need walkers and wheelchairs. What we have failed at least in a lot of communities, is accessible housing that is affordable. Mm-hmm. And so putting those two things together has been a real challenge. I know we face this here in Oxford. It's been a challenge. There are federal programs for special housing for adults and people with disabilities. Those are few and far between in many communities. It's a continuing challenge, and it often falls to individual communities to take it on themselves, and so it varies widely depending on where you live, what kinds of housing opportunities you may have access to.
We have a question from the audience. Go right ahead.
Can you guys hear me?
Sure can. Mm-hmm.
So my question stems from aging being both a privilege and in some ways a mark of disenfranchisement for certain communities that may have different cultures and practices towards aging communities. We've seen an evolution of behaviors towards terminal illness and lack of financial planning, such as different GoFundMes for people that haven't planned for their terminal life or family members' terminal life. We see a lack of education towards investing towards your future. I myself know about living wills and things of that nature. I wanted to ask, what are some new trends of the mindset of aging and terminal life that has positively affected the larger aging community? And then the second part of that is, what should we be considering while aging?
A very big question, and I might have to ask you to repeat the second part of it, but one of the issues that you raised, which is incredibly important, is the extent to which some societies, including ours, have equated aging with dying. And I think really part of we are a death-denying society, and aging means that we're getting closer to death, so that we have really wanted to sort of avoid the whole thing. There's good news with a lot of initiatives related to palliative care, end-of-life planning, advanced directives, having the conversation, conscious dying. That language, that discussion is entering into our conversations more and more in care settings, but also there's a lot of encouragement for families to have those conversations before we're in the midst of a crisis. So to the extent that we can sort of deal with our fears about dying by talking about dying, it also helps us separate the aging process from the dying process. People involved in palliative care are often quick to say that we're not talking about you planning for your death. We're helping you plan for how you want to live your life for the rest of the time that you have left. So I think the more open we are about those issues of death and the way that we have maybe unconsciously attached them to aging, the better off we'll be in thinking about aging as a lifelong process.
And that goes to your second question, which really is about thinking about aging throughout our lives. And I think, as Suzanne indicated, we know that there are many things that we can do in our lives that will help us have a better old age. Some of it is luck, of course, but we know about diet and exercise and being able to be healthy from an emotional perspective. And I think that one of the things we've learned is that the things that you do in your 30s and 40s and 50s do impact your old age. And so we talk about cumulative advantage and disadvantages, so that if you're going to have bad nutrition in your 30s and 40s, that's not going to bode well for old age. So it is the case that we're thinking about aging across the spectrum, and that you do need to prepare for a good old age, even though it's far away.
And the other part of your question that I did want to respond to was related to the idea of disenfranchisement, but also cumulative advantage and disadvantage. This is not simply a matter of making good choices and, you know, being that noble person who really does exercise five times a week and only eats fruits and eats nine servings of fruits and vegetables a day. It's not only about individual choice. There are patterns of disadvantage and inequality that follow us across our life course, and I think that's really important to acknowledge. This is not just a matter of encouraging people to make better choices. It's looking at the ways in which we unequally make opportunities available to different groups of people in our society, including older adults.
Susan, can you explain what you mentioned, having the conversation? Can you explain exactly what that means?
So there's a hospice initiative, and I'm forgetting the name of it, but it's called something like the Conversation Project, where they...
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, so this is an outreach public awareness project that hospice has initiated, where they had folks standing on street corners with signs that said things like, "That smile looks great on you." And you would say, "Well, thanks, but what's this about?" And then they would raise the topic of having the conversations about, again, life planning and end-of-life planning.
Sounds like that would be a very tough conversation to have. I mean, how do you start that conversation?
Well, I think it is tough, but, you know, as the questioner raised, being able to even begin to think about doing the paperwork for having a living will or a health care proxy, power of attorney, those are all the things that everybody, as we age, needs to think about, and unfortunately, many of us don't. So that if you have to fill out that paperwork, then you have to have that conversation with your loved ones to say, if something happens to me, this is what I want. And one of our challenges is that we're spending a lot of money on health care in the very end of life because people haven't really thought about what they need or want. And so it can be very expensive, and it could be not exactly what people want. So having that conversation is essential. Yes, it is hard to do, but not having it is still hard to do.
And I don't know how many of you in this room have had this experience. I certainly have. I suspect I'm not the only one. Where the older people in our lives give us cues that they want to have the conversation, but then we respond by saying, "Oh, Grandma, you're going to outlive all of us." Well, that's simply not true, and we don't want to talk about it, but she's made it clear that she does want to talk about it. So I think it is getting comfortable and looking for those openings to have the conversation whenever it might occur naturally.
How well are most people prepared financially as they enter their older years?
Well, you know, as Suzanne indicated, there's a lot of variability in the aging process. And so for about half of the older population, we're not that well prepared. About 40% of the older population relies almost exclusively on Social Security. The average Social Security payment last year was $1,400 a month. And so those folks, only about half of us have private pensions. And as we know, the savings rate in the U.S. isn't that good. We're not that good at saving, but we're pretty good at using our credit cards. And so when you put those all together, we have a big chunk of our older population that really aren't well prepared financially. Of course, we have a small sector that is well prepared, but about half of us are not very well prepared at all.
And do you think that means that people are going to have to work longer? That the idea of retiring when you're in your 60s is something that may be going by the wayside?
Well, certainly the case that there was a while where we saw a trend towards early retirement, and that has changed now. So we are seeing people work longer. Certainly the downtrend in the economy in 2008, where a lot of people lost some of their portfolios, has certainly incentivized people to work longer. And certainly, you know, we're living longer. We've raised the retirement age from 65 to 67, and there are some that have argued that we ought to raise retirement age for Social Security to 70, and that's being debated now because you may know that the Social Security Trust Fund, which was supposed to take us through the entire baby boom generation, is now set to run out in 2035. And so one of the solutions to that is indeed to raise retirement. So I think a lot of people are saying we should work longer if we can, and it's one of the things that are being debated about in national policy.
I've heard some people who forecast the future say working in your 80s, if you're physically able, may become a necessity.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if we'll go that far, but certainly we are seeing an extended work life for some people. And, of course, it gets very difficult because if you're in a very active physical labor job, it may be difficult to put on a new roof at age 80, whereas working at the university, maybe we can keep going for a while.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction to make. There's sort of the have to work until age 80 versus I have things to contribute, I have things I still want to do, I have things that I'm able to do, and if we make the proper shifts, there should be opportunities for me to do those valued engagements and get paid for them if that's what I need. If it's not what I need, then maybe I can volunteer or make a contribution in another way. But I think it's important to consider want to versus have to. Mm-hmm.
So it's an issue of planning things out ahead of time. Is that what you're saying, Jane?
Well, it's
thinking
it's,
about what you want to do.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
We have an email from Tripp, and he says, how do you talk to older parents about moving from a potentially dangerous house and to someplace safer, say a retirement community?
Well, it's an incredibly difficult situation, but for the residents and that we deal with that are in an unsafe situation, we just have to involve family, have to talk with that resident and lay out the risks and the benefits of the current situation. You know, in some cases, it's more clear than not that it's not safe, and we need to talk about alternatives, whether it's getting you more services in the home. If this is where you want to be, then, you know, we can look at some different services to keep you here. Otherwise, we need to look at, you know, modifying the home or possibly moving to a higher level of care. So it's not an easy conversation.
But I think it's a very common conversation. There are plenty of folks who say, I'm not going out of here until it's, you know, feet first. And as Ross mentioned, just bringing in some services or making modifications to do whatever you can to assist the parent in being as safe as they possibly can while they remain where they are.
But and I think that's one of the things that's changed. I think we used to be very quick to say, oh, you can't possibly stay in your home anymore. But now we're much better. We have a much better in-home service network. We're much better at thinking about how we can modify the conditions of the home. And so I think people are staying home longer and longer, and that's good. It still could be the case that it may not be the right place, but we're doing much better. We also get these same issues surrounding things like driving and being able to be independent. So there are some tough issues that we certainly face as we age.
Well, the driving issue is a tough one. I went through that with my father-in-law at age 83. Same kind of question as how do you start that conversation with somebody about moving into a safer place? How do you start the whole conversation about driving? That's a difficult one because you're asking somebody to give up their degree of independence.
I can speak to that a little bit. We recently started a driver evaluation program that we're doing. So instead of the message being we're going to take your keys away, it's how can we evaluate you and your car and your driving capability, and how can we enable you to continue to drive safely. So I think with, you know, back to aging in place, you know, what can we do to enable you to stay in your home? What can we do to enable you to continue to drive rather than take things away?
And I think it's related to conversations about goals and recognizing what the older individual's goals may be, having them articulate that. So the fear about giving up driving, I think it is complicated because cars equal independence in our society. But what is it about loss of driving that worries you the most? What are the places that are most important for you to get to? And a similar conversation about moving out of a home that has maybe been a lifelong home. Very complicated, but how can we think about goals moving forward and steps we can take to help achieve those goals?
And in terms of those goals, I also think it's important for the parent, parent to have goals and the adult child to have goals, and to acknowledge that maybe the adult child's goals for the parent to be safe may not be at all matching with what the parent's goals are. And so it's a tough conversation and a tough negotiation, but it's sort of addressing the fact that maybe these things have to be negotiated as well.
And this is related to the back to the planning issue. A few years ago, AARP did a survey in Claremont County in which they asked people if they thought they would always be able to drive, and 90% of the boomers said yes. But the bad news is, if you live long enough, you're probably not going to be able to drive all your life. And so we're not well prepared for this. And so these are the kinds of preparation issues that are hard to talk about, but they're important to talk about.
You can join us this afternoon by emailing your questions to talk at WVXU.org or by finding us on Facebook or Twitter. And we're also taking questions from the audience. So you've been waiting patiently up there. Thank you so much. What's your question?
For some of us with parents who want to age in place, distance is an issue. Are there recommendations for monitoring devices or other technology we could use to help us keep better in touch?
I think technology is definitely an enabler, and I'm a big fan of it. We have done different things. I can't give you specific examples, but there's definitely monitoring systems in place, whether it's motion sensors. You would be able to tell if someone has gotten up for the day. There's all sorts of different sensors you can use depending on the use. But you could see if they have got food in their fridge, things like that. Skype, communication technology, telehealth, all sorts of different things.
Yes, we're seeing tremendous changes in technology. They're still developing, but as Ross said, the kinds of things where you can monitor a relative from a distance, we're just at the edge. Some retirement communities are building new construction where they actually have a laser going across the bedroom door, and if the person doesn't come out by a certain time, they call them. We've seen some technologies where you can actually pick up a change in the person's gait so that they may be susceptible to falling. So there are lots of things going on. And then, of course, we see, particularly in Japan, where they're aging at a much more rapid rate than we are, the development of robotics. Both Honda and Toyota have invested a lot of money in robots. The Rosie the Robot that we grew up watching on the Jetsons is now being developed.
Well, some of us did.
Now being developed. And so I think that the future of aging will include robotics, where we have somebody that will help us with some of those tasks. And, of course, we talked about driving in the earlier segment. Now we're talking a lot about the self-driving car. And while all these things are just a little bit scary and a little Orwellian, this is the future. It's going to include technology.
Mm-hmm. Jane, did you want to add to that?
No.
Okay. All right. Next question.
We've heard of some of the challenges that come along with an aging population. Are there any advantages or benefits to look forward to?
Thank you for that question. Absolutely. In fact, there's a really important idea being talked about in the field of gerontology, but even more broadly than that, and it's called the longevity dividend. And it's the idea that all of these investments that we're making in helping people live longer and be healthier longer really has an opportunity to pay off, not just for individuals, but for their families and their communities and for societies in general. And it may take the shape of working longer, contributing to, continuing to pay taxes, contributing in that way. But it also refers to civic engagement and volunteer opportunities. And we have a lag. We have a lag in our society between the number of people who are ready to help us take advantage of that longevity dividend. We have a lot of older people who just can't find the right opportunities, or they confront ageism when they do seek out those opportunities. So yes, I think there are tremendous opportunities, and that the longevity dividend is a really interesting idea that there are several scholars writing about this. Linda Fried is one of them, and she talks very explicitly about the fact that older societies with lots of healthy older adults seeking to contribute can actually benefit by having, again, paid jobs, but also voluntary jobs, intergenerational relationships strengthened because of the availability of older adults who want to remain engaged. So I think our challenge is to think creatively about that and to put structures in place so that it's not so hard for older adults to continue to contribute.
Suzanne mentioned ageism, and I think that that's one of the issues that has caused us to focus on sometimes on just the challenges. And as you are, as I know you're aware, there's a pretty extensive movement to sort of reframe how we think about aging and to focus on the positives, to really look at our attitudes towards aging, because we actually have the opportunity kind of to reimagine all the ways in which older adults can contribute. We have not had a society with this many older adults before, so we actually don't know what's possible. But as those of us who are aging think about what we want to do, we certainly will change it, I have no doubt.
One of our colleagues at the Scripps Gerontology Center is working on a couple of projects looking at the ways in which older adults can go back to school to get a new certificate for a particular set of skills to either re-enter the labor force or to upgrade their skills for a different kind of job in the industry they've been working in. But there are a lot of barriers. There are a lot of barriers for people to enter those kinds of programs, and so her work is really looking at what those barriers are and finding out ways that community colleges and other educational institutions can really minimize some of those barriers so that more opportunities are available, including education for its own sake, but also education for employment.
Yeah, one of my favorite barriers at one of the universities in the state, not ours, had somebody who was returning to college in their 60s, and they had a requirement that they're supposed to live in the dorm, and so they had to fight that one. So there are a number of barriers to being able to return to school.
Are there programs that offer educational opportunities, Bob, that are out there?
Yes, and as Suzanne mentioned, a number of the community colleges have been doing retraining, trying to identify people whose job may have changed or who may have lost their job, and so we're seeing an increase in interest in that area. We, of course, across the state of Ohio, have had the Over 60 Audit Program for many years, where people over 60 can audit a class if it's available. So there are a number of both just educational and also employment-related opportunities for people who want to return to school.
Right ahead.
Yes. I'm curious to know, do you have any statistics on the number of people, say 65 and older, that are still working, whether they're working full-time, part-time? And is there another level that maybe after 70, are you seeing a trend of more people working?
Yes, there are good national and state statistics that I'm not going to be able to quote at the moment, but there's certainly been a steady increase in continued participation in the labor force, 65 plus. I do know that the composition of the labor force is changing, partly because of the aging of our society. By 2024, something like 45% of the labor force will be people who are 45 and older. When you get into workforce statistics related to aging, they define aging very differently than I do. It starts at either age 40 or 45, which you're barely a kid by then, in my estimation. But so the aging of the labor force, just by virtue of the number of older people who remain in the labor force, is really quite dramatic. And there has been a marked increase in labor force involvement.
Sarah emailed. She was asking, other than Uber and driverless cars, are other forms of transportation being looked at for someone who can no longer drive so they can remain independent?
Well, we actually have seen a little bit of an interest in the private transportation companies like Uber and Lyft getting into trying to get into a older market as well. And so we are seeing those kinds of things. Certainly transportation is a big part of many retirement communities. But one of the challenges is that if you just live in regular suburban or even rural Ohio, if you don't drive, you're pretty much out of the mainstream.
What about public transportation? Is that just not adequate for providing service for folks who are older?
I think there are challenges associated with public transportation for older individuals. But I think, again, when if we look back at some of the things we talked about, if we could modify that, I think that could be an option.
For some places that have really good public transportation, there's still is the issue of getting to the bus stop or the metro stop. So there's still the issue of getting from your front door to where you pick up that bus. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunity. We've talked about housing. We've talked about transportation. Every survey of every community, every national survey of aging in the United States, when people are asked to list the things that they're most concerned about in their community, well, number one always is health. But what about your community? Are you hoping for some better services? It's always related to housing and transportation. Those are the two biggest needs.
Transportation is a really hard one to address because it needs to be convenient, reliable, when you want it. And Suzanne sort of mentioned the door-to-door, people who may need assistance getting from their door to whatever they're going to be transported in. We haven't talked about this, but there are a system of long-term services and supports in Southwest Ohio. We're very lucky that we have county levy programs here that do provide some transportation services. So there are things out there besides complete public transportation and Uber specials, so specialized transportation for older adults.
And Suzanne mentioned health care. What kinds of changes are doctors going to have to make to deal with this older population? Are they going to have to change the way they approach their patients and the way they think as this progresses?
Are they going to have to, or do we wish that they would?
Whichever one you want.
It's hard to think of a medical specialty where at least some portion of your clients won't be older adults. The specialty of geriatric medicine, is, I think, a model for how to best work with older patients, but it is not that, and the model is very holistic. It's a commitment to really understanding not only how every physiological system of the older person works together, but also the fact that they're embedded in a certain living situation and there may be family members involved in the conversations. So that holistic, person-centered approach is something we would like to see. There are a lot of specialties where that's just not built into the way they do their very important work, but I don't think we're going to transform every medical specialty into that holistic view. But that is what would be ideal for older people and for the rest of us as well, for all of us.
And I think that's really one of our challenges. We know that older people, particularly as they hit the older ages, have more chronic diseases, and our healthcare system is organized around one thing. So you might be a specialist in cardiology, you might be a specialist in cancer, but for older people that have multiple chronic diseases, they're not getting the care that they need because it's too fragmented. And so we have a real serious problem. And in fact, today we have fewer geriatricians than we did 10 years ago, even though we have so many more older people, because it doesn't pay as well as a number of the specialties. So we could do a whole another hour on just the healthcare system related to older people, but it is a challenge, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Another question from the audience. Go right ahead.
I'm involved with the Age Friendly Oxford initiative as a volunteer, and I would just like to thank Scripps Gerontology Center, the City of Oxford, Oxford Seniors, AARP Ohio, and National AARP for putting us on this path to improving quality of life for older adults here in the Oxford area. My question has to do with, back out at the state level, since we're the sixth oldest and most rapidly aging state in Ohio, what are the policies or incentives or initiatives that how is our state responding to this trend? And you know, what kind of policies for workforce development or housing development are needed, and where are we compared to where we need to be?
That's a great question, and I'm sorry we're out of time.
We have 2 minutes.
I think that the state, as Jane said, has made a lot of progress in reforming the long-term care system in terms of spending more money on community care and less money on nursing home care. But I think one of the problems is that we spend Medicaid is our income or welfare program for people that need long-term care, and Medicaid is now a quarter of our entire state budget. And so our state legislators are so worried about controlling Medicaid costs that that's where a lot of our efforts go, but only about 10% of older people in Ohio are on Medicaid. So we don't do enough to keep people from ending up there, but we do a lot once they get there to figure out how to respond to the crisis. And so our challenge is, as we move forward, is how are we going to prevent people from getting to the point where the wheels have fallen off? How do we help them stay in their community? And that's really where most states, including Ohio, have not been able to do what they need to do.
And I would like to acknowledge the incredible impact of grassroots efforts as Age Friendly Oxford indeed was, and it was people in this room who started that effort. Because of that, we now have city council involved. Because of that, we now have other cities in the state of Ohio involved. And I think there are a lot of really important seeds that can be planted starting at the local level that can raise awareness. Really call out issues of ageism in our policies. We have such fragmented policies that either intentionally or unintentionally affect older adults, but the extent to which we can raise awareness about aging, I think the better off we'll be. I think we're a long way from having an integrated statewide policy related to aging, but the more we can raise issues of older workers and, again, age-friendly communities, the more people are just going to be aware.
And we'd like to thank everybody on the panel this afternoon. Thank you so much for being here today. Thanks to Miami University for hosting us this afternoon, with special thanks to Miami President Dr. Gregory Crawford, University News and Communications, Intercollegiate Athletics, Miami's football program, Coach Chuck Martin, and Coach Matt Yoches. Our producer today was Pete Reitmeier, with special help from Ritter Hoy. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Our engineers were Rick Andres and Josh Elstro. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU and 88.5 WMUB.